Albert Einstein once said, "If you can't explain it to a six-year-old, you don't understand it yourself." Sometimes technology makes us feel like six-year-olds, especially when hackers try to use the internet to steal something from each of us. If you think you have nothing of value to a hacker, think again. You and everyone you know are exactly who hackers target every day. This is DIY Cyber Guy with David W. Schroefer. Every week, he will show you how cybersecurity can be as easy as locking up your house at night. Now, here is your host, David W. Schroefer.
Welcome to DIY Cyber Guy, the show that puts the Zoom in doom and gloom. No, really, it's not that bad. I'm sure you've all seen articles this week that have talked about how the world is falling down in terms of Intel chips and some of your home Wi-Fi routers. Not everything is really that bad. So, you know the song by Jim Croce, Don't Mess Around With Jim. Don't tug on Superman's cape. Don't spit in the wind. Don't pull the mask off the Lone Ranger. And don't mess around with Jim. Well, that's really good advice that will help you keep out of trouble if you happen to live, you know, back there and back then. This show is very much the same. We're all on the internet. And if you follow just a few rules and do's and don'ts, you really will avoid some of the trouble that's waiting for you out there. So we have another great show for you today that will touch about just about everybody who uses a computer at all. Seriously, this week covers the Huawei router hack, which is a must fix if you have a Huawei router in your home or your office. Intel computers, which is, of course, a very wide range of computers that are on our various desks around the world. If you start your car with a touch of a button, as opposed to putting a key in the ignition, and you like your car and want to keep it, please pay close attention to a new hack that's out there. Bitcoin. If you use Bitcoin or you think you have some Bitcoin, perhaps in an old digital wallet somewhere, or you know anyone who uses Bitcoin in any way, you really need to listen to the show. We have a hack that is a little more unnerving than a traditional hack. Also, our guest is Philip Andre, who will help us understand why we can't swipe our credit cards like the old days. And he also fills in some blanks on Bitcoin as well. So let's get started. The Huawei hack. So first of all, Huawei is spelled H-U-A-W-E-I. That's H-U-A-W-E-I. I'm repeating that because if you think you have one, you need to go, or you're not sure, you need to go look at your Wi-Fi router and see if that's the name or that's the label on the outside of the unit. It's called the Huawei Econet router, and it is specifically model HG532, which is one of the more popular models. But really, to be safe, this really applies to everybody who has the Huawei Ecolife home router at all. The fix is to simply change the password, and we're going to talk about why you want to do that and also how to do that during the course of this segment. So this is an active hack. Last week we talked about some vulnerabilities that were found by the good guys, which means that nobody's really been attacked with the vulnerability yet, but in this case, it's out there. The last couple of weeks, hundreds of thousands of computers and home Econet routers have already been infected with this virus. And what it does is it actually gives the attacker the ability to make your Wi-Fi router part of what's called a botnet. A botnet is a very bad thing to be a part of. Why is it bad? A botnet can literally tell your computer or your, in this case, your Wi-Fi router, exactly what to do. It will send messages or send requests to any computer it wants to all around the world. It can have millions of computers doing the same thing at the same time. It can take down any website anywhere. It can block all internet traffic to a certain geographic area. It can mine Bitcoin without you knowing. It can make your computer do things that you don't otherwise know that it's doing. That's why a botnet is bad. So not only is this hack capable of making your Wi-Fi router part of a botnet, but it can also do something that's even worse than that, which is give the attacker full control of your computer. Now, what we have seen out there in the wild, so to speak, are the botnet attacks based on this malware. What we haven't seen is an attacker actually take control of a computer that's on the network, but you don't want to wait for that to happen to you. So again, the fix is, and this is straight from Huawei, all you have to do is change the password. Why do you need to do that? Well, I'll tell you. Because the password default is admin, A-D-M-I-N. And the default username is also admin, A-D-M-I-N. Doesn't take a rocket science to figure out that if you just guess that that's the username and password of a router that you may be able to attack if you're a hacker, you might be able to get in and do some damage there. So that's effectively what we're talking about. So here's how you fix this problem. When you're on a computer that's on your network, on your Huawei Wi-Fi, go to a browser, and instead of typing in where you normally type a website, like Amazon.com or eBay.com, type in exactly this, 192.168.1.1. And I'll repeat that, 192.168.1.1. And what that's going to do is open up a panel, basically a view into the control panel of your Huawei router. And once you get in there, change your password. It'll ask you to log in. Now remember, the username is admin, and the password is admin, all lowercase, just those five letters, A-D-M-I-N. Once you've logged in, you will be able to change the password in the maintenance field. At least that'll apply to most of you, but it shouldn't be very hard to do. Once you've changed the password, you've effectively solved the problem, at least to the extent that the company tells us it can be solved. So I've got notes on the website at DIYCyberGuy.com if you want to read more about how this attack works or more detail on how to fix it. But to recap, it's a critical problem. If you have a Huawei router, please go fix it. Fix it quickly. Reset your password as quickly as you can and go to the website DIYCyberGuy if you have any questions. Okay. Next, the Intel AMT flaw. Now, this is a varying scale on the hair on fire scale. So if you're just a computer user and you've got a small network, maybe you've got a Wi-Fi router at home, or perhaps you just have one or two laptops that are connected to your home computer, you don't have a guest network, then this is a hair on fire one on a scale of 1 to 5. Don't really have to worry about it. You might want to take care of it, but as long as you keep that guest network closed, you really should be okay as long as your computers stay in your control. On the other side of the scale, though, if you perhaps have a small business, anything from a flower shop, a hair salon, whatever, and maybe you thought you'd be magnanimous to your guests and open up a Wi-Fi channel that doesn't have a password, that could actually open up a problem. So if that's the case and that's you, then this probably is a 5 out of 5, meaning, hey, stop what you're doing and listen to this carefully. Again, if you miss anything, you can just go to the show notes on the website at DIYCyberGuy.com. So first and foremost, if you've got an unsecured Wi-Fi, just put a password on it. Even if you put a simple password, like perhaps the name of the street where your business is or something like that, it's really a very easy thing to do. Never leave an open Wi-Fi guest network on your network or an open network at all, unless maybe you're Starbucks. And I'm guessing if you're listening to this show, you're not Starbucks. So, and don't make the password password one, please. Make just an 8-character password, maybe something that has to do with your business or your street or something like that. And if you need to tell your customers, put a card on every table or anywhere they can read it. Just don't paint it on the wall so you can see it from outside your store. It's very, very simple. But it's really, in general, a dangerous thing to have an open guest network running on your computer. So apparently this is another case where there's a username and password that are both set to admin. A password was found in the program that runs in the central processor in your computer, software package called the BIOS software. So here's what the bad guy does. And this is all public information, so I'm not telling any hackers something that they don't already know. And remember, you've got a link in the show notes if you want to get some more details. So here's what the hacker does. First, the hacker gets physical access of your computer. They have to turn it off, and they turn it back on. While it's turning back on, they hit Control-P, or something similar, depending on the computer, which switches them to the BIOS extension, which is a control panel deep inside your computer, which asks for a username and password. And once again, just like we saw with Huawei, username is admin, password is admin. At that point, after the user logs in using admin as the username and password, the hacker can get remote access to your computer, meaning they can see and do anything that you're doing on your computer. They can make your computer do anything they want it to do. And if you're processing payments or dealing with sensitive customer information, that's a very significant problem for you and your business. So you really want to fix that. They can also change the password of the BIOS software, which means that even if you wanted to fix this, you couldn't get back in to do that. They would basically have that kind of control. And they could do all of this wireless, from a wireless standpoint, kind of. They would still need to be on your Wi-Fi network, which is why I say if you've got a small business with a guest network, this could really, really open up a lot of vulnerability if somebody is able to do this very simple hack, which takes only a matter of seconds, really, having control of your computer and possibly having control of your entire network as well. So the fix is, first, you have to figure out if you've got an Intel chip that's got this vulnerability. So how do you do that? On a MacBook, very simple. You click the Apple icon in the extreme upper left-hand corner, and the first option that comes down is about this Mac. Then you click that, the pop-up window that comes up will tell you a few things about the computer. Look for the term processor. If you see the word Intel, then congratulations, you might have this vulnerability. Now, if you have a Windows computer, it's slightly different. So you click on the Start button to open your Start window, and then right-click on either this PC, or if you have Windows 7, it's probably still My Computer. Then click on Properties and check the processor that's listed in the System section inside the Properties window. Again, if you see Intel, then you probably have a problem to fix. All you have to do is change the password, but you have to change it to anything but admin, like before in the Huawei fix. Now, here's the thing. You've got to do this carefully. I'm going to walk you through it. And again, if you don't get all of this, just go to the website, DIY Cyber Guy, and you'll see the step-by-step instructions. So make sure your head is clear, your room is clear, nobody is distracting you, because if you're going into the BIOS control panel to fix this, which is a very sensitive place, which is code for, if you make a mistake in there, you could turn your computer into a very expensive brick, which is not very good for processing or writing letters or anything like that. Can basically totally kill it. So that's the warning. But if you just follow the steps, you shouldn't run into that at all. So what you want to do is basically follow the same steps as the hacker would have taken. Reboot your computer. Most of you will hit Control-P at the same time while it's booting back up before it gets all the way booted up. And that will get you into the BIOS settings. For others, you might need to hit F2 for some Dell computers. But again, there's a link in the show notes to give you some more detail on that. And that'll bring up the BIOS setting where there's a separate tab called Intel AMT. And that stands for Active Management Technology. Okay, and then follow the steps to change the password. The instructions, since you're probably logging in for the first time, the instructions would pop up on the screen. Again, you're using admin as the username, admin as the password. All you want to do once you're in there is change the password. Now, important, if you see things that I'm not talking about when you reboot and hit Control-P, you may not have the particular type of Intel chip that's causing this issue. So just stop and exit. Don't save anything. Just get out of there and go back to using your computer as usual. Okay, so once the password is reset, that's it. The problem's solved and the computer is safe. And again, for more information on this, you can Google the words, how do I change my Intel AMT password? Again, how do I change my Intel AMT password? Just Google those terms or click the link in the show notes and you will get a really good step-by-step process of what's the problem and how to fix it. Okay, so to recap, this is really only bad if you have a network, if you have a small business, if somebody has physical access to your computer. A small business with Wi-Fi is a little more at risk than a home user, and the fix is just a few steps that you have to take carefully to change the password. But once you're done, and you're not vulnerable anymore. Okay, so hang in there. We'll be right back with more on DIY Cyber Guy.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
Anchor ID is a new way to log into websites and mobile apps, all without a password. The key is your smartphone, literally. Your smartphone is the key that will replace the need for passwords to your online sites. Our next product will be available to Salesforce.com users soon. To sign up for the first year free, just go to anchorid.com/Salesforce. Visit anchorid.com/Salesforce and get your first year free.
Have you friended us on Facebook yet?
Why not?
Just go to facebook.com/Voice America or search for the keywords Voice America. Once you are part of our Facebook network, you'll receive daily messages about what's happening with our shows, this week's featured guests, and new happenings at the Voice America Talk Radio Network. And you can add your voice to the always active discussions on our timeline. Just go to facebook.com/Voice America or search for Voice America.
You are listening to DIY Cyber Guy with David W. Schroefer. If you have a question for David, please send it to questions@DIYCyberGuy.com. That's questions@DIYCyberGuy.com. Now, back to the show.
Okay, welcome back to DIY Cyber Guy. This next segment is about Bitcoin. So if you hold any Bitcoin or you know anybody that does, or thinks that they do, then you definitely need to listen to this section very, very carefully, because it has to do, of course, with cybercrime. So usually when we talk about cybercrime, we're talking about hacks and viruses and people who can attack you literally from the other side of the world. This is a case where a man was held up at gunpoint for his Bitcoin. So here's just a little context first. In January of 2011, Bitcoin was worth about 31 cents. So if you had about 100 Bitcoin, it was worth $31. Fast forward 7 years to 2018, at the time of this recording, if you have that same 100 Bitcoin, it's worth $1.14 million. That's right. A single Bitcoin is now worth $11,400 as of today, and that's up from about 31 cents in January of 2011. So that's made a few unlikely millionaires out there, people who had a few Bitcoin years and years ago and all of a sudden find that those Bitcoin are worth quite a bit of money. So in this case, a man had $1.8 million worth of Bitcoin in his digital wallet, and he bragged about it with some people that he probably shouldn't have. And one of those people held him up at gunpoint, managed to get his key or his secret away from him, and then transferred the money from his account to the thief's account. That's a lot of money. Here's the problem. This is not like a bank. Once that money was transferred, the victim cannot get it back. He can press charges, but there really is no way to get a Bitcoin back once it has been stolen. So here to talk about that with us and explain more about Bitcoin is Philip Andre. Welcome, Philip.
Good evening or good afternoon, David. How are you this week?
Doing great, thanks. And for those of you who don't know Philip Andre, he is formerly of Obiter and from the board of the FIDO Alliance, and he's also the godfather of Chip and Pin. So we'll talk about that a little bit in the next segment. So, Philip, what recourse does somebody have if they either spend Bitcoin with the wrong person, or in the case of this terrible story, somebody actually manages to get their key away from them at gunpoint and manages to steal their Bitcoin? How can they get them back?
Well, unfortunately, David, Bitcoin, when it was originally designed, it was designed to replicate the concepts of cash in such a way that an equivalent to cash could be provided on a global scale. So like if somebody is to pickpocket and take your wallet out of your back pocket or out of your purse, out of your handbag, it's gone. And that is the reality of how Bitcoin was designed, that it's this irrefutable value that once exchanged is permanently exchanged, so that when that criminal acquired that key and executed the appropriate transaction, he now owned those coins and was able to do whatever he wanted to do with those coins. It's fundamental to the design.
So what is it about structure? What is it about the structure of Bitcoin that allows that to happen? And I'll give some context to my question. I have a bank account, and that bank account, my understanding is basically a ledger. I make deposits, I make withdrawals, and I spend money on my debit card. And those are transactions that simply come in and out of the ledger, credits and debits on the ledger. And then at the end of the day, of course, there's a balance remaining as a net result of all those transactions. Isn't Bitcoin basically the same thing? Isn't it basically a ledger?
Absolutely. The difference between that centralized ledger and a Bitcoin ledger is one word, which is a distributed ledger. So in the concept of Bitcoin, the idea was to remove the central authority, the financial institution, the central bank, the government, and create this thing called a distributed ledger, which existed in the computers of everybody who participated in the Bitcoin environment. And every implementation or every copy of that lock, as we call it, and Bitcoin is managed using something called blockchain technology, every transaction that ever occurred is stored in that blockchain. And every transaction that will ever occur will be stored in that blockchain. And that blockchain will be distributed to everybody who participates so that everybody knows where the coins are and everybody is able to reconcile the balance of coins that any individual on that ledger holds. If I look at a centralized ledger, somebody, a data administrator, for example, could walk into a computer room, they could sign on to a screen, and they could modify the ledger, and nobody would be the wiser. In the case of Bitcoin and blockchain, if somebody modifies the ledger, they only modify one copy, and everybody would reconcile that that copy doesn't equal the copy that we all have, so therefore it doesn't, it's a bad copy and gets deleted from the world.
Okay, so what you're saying is the basic concept of a distributed ledger is it is exact copies of the same ledger that lots of different people have around the world. So if one ledger gets corrupted, you know, for example, somebody saying, no, I credited 100 Bitcoin on this transaction, not just one Bitcoin. If they tried to change that in the ledger for their own benefit, that would be instantly detectable because that ledger would in some way not match all of the other carbon copies of that same ledger that exist around the world. Is that about right?
That's about right. That we could get into the mathematics and the cryptography that's going to do that, but I don't think for this audience we want to get into that level of complexity. The people who designed the Bitcoin architecture, designed the Bitcoin components, built an architecture that, number one, ensured trust. Number two, provided a distributed mechanism that if anybody altered their copy, when their copy was compared to everybody else's copy, it would not match, and therefore it could be rejected. Number three, it created this ability to decentralize and assure the irrefutability. And a key word, coming back to the criminal, is the irrefutability of the transaction. If you and I were to exchange Bitcoins, I would sign, I'm giving David a Bitcoin, and you would sign that you received a Bitcoin. And because we both agreed that that Bitcoin had been exchanged, it would be logged on the ledger, distributed to everybody in the world, and everybody would know that David received a Bitcoin for Philip. Now, I've used our names. The reality of Bitcoin, we would...
Yeah, we would be numbers or a username, basically.
Yes, we wouldn't even be a username. We'd be a random number that is pretty damn long and allows some degree of anonymity.
Okay, so really, there's nobody to go to, is really what you're saying. If this had been a case of a wallet getting stolen and somebody taking a Visa card and going off and buying a bunch of things as a result of a theft, then I could go to my credit card, the bank that issued my credit card, and say, look, I was robbed. They took my wallet before I could report it. They bought all these things. And I wouldn't be responsible. I have somebody to go to, and that somebody, in that example, is my bank. You're saying in the case of Bitcoin, there's nobody to go to because it's a distributed ledger.
Well, in fact, if we go back to the Visa card that you use, that's because there is a government regulation, it's called Reg E, that specifically identifies the consumer risk. In the case of Bitcoin, like cash, if you lose it, it's gone.
So what would you recommend for people that are out there? Now, you know, again, there are a lot of people who have Bitcoin and use it every day and feel comfortable keeping it safe. There are a lot of other people who have Bitcoin and really don't know what they're doing with it. I've heard lots of stories about people who earned a Bitcoin or two or 12 or 102 years ago, so long ago that they've now retired the computer that was holding the Bitcoin that had negligible value then and are worth in the hundreds of thousands or even millions of dollars now. And now they're going to go try to find those old computers. So what advice would you have for those people who don't really know what they're doing with Bitcoin?
Number one, I would strongly recommend that you figure out a way to keep a copy of the secret that belongs to you. And in the basic concept of Bitcoin means that we each have a secret and we're going to sign our transactions, our Bitcoins, with that secret. If you have your secret, the Bitcoin actually lives on the ledger. The problem is to claim it, you have to have the secret, very much like a password. The difference between a password and the secret is nobody else but you has the secret. Nobody wants, or you don't want anybody else to have it, because if they had it, they'd be able to take your coins. So number one.
So with just the secret, somebody else would be able to complete the transaction from both ends, from my Bitcoin account to their Bitcoin account, with just that password.
Absolutely. Correct. Just that secret. That secret is the key. It's just like the key to your house. If there's only one key to your house and you lose the key, the only way to get into your house, assuming it's an iron vault, is with dynamite. And in the case of Bitcoin, we've made it impervious to any form of attack. Without the key, you can't get in. Therefore, without the key, you've lost your coins.
Okay. Well, so I guess to wrap up this segment for our listeners, if you have Bitcoin and you have any concerns that somebody else may have the key or somebody else may get the key, one of the things you can do is change the key. Go into your whatever vault you're using to carry around your Bitcoin or digital wallet you're using for your Bitcoin. Go in and change the key to something very random. And one of the suggestions I give my listeners is to simply write it down on a good old-fashioned piece of paper and put that piece of paper somewhere secure, because if there isn't a digital record, if you haven't made a digital file of it somewhere, then it can't be hacked. Paper can't be hacked. And number two, if you're still concerned that somebody might be able to get your key even after that, maybe it's time to get out of Bitcoin and have them exchanged for good old-fashioned U.S. dollars or whatever your local currency is, and move into a currency that's a little bit more safe.
Yeah. And I'd go one step farther. I'd take that piece of paper and I'd take it to your trusted bank and I'd put it in your safe deposit box along with your jewelry, your will, and the other very important documents and artifacts that are dear and very important to you. And I remember what happened to so many people in the multiple hurricanes, that they lost it all because something happened. You've got to protect what you own, which is your Bitcoin, which is controlled and managed by your key. So the most important asset you have in a Bitcoin environment is that secret, that password. And you need to make a copy of it and store it someplace very safe. It's not in the same place that you live.
That's great advice, Philip. Thank you. So if you want to get a good description of exactly what Bitcoin is and what Bitcoin isn't, there's a site out there called My Ethernet Wallet. And before My Ethernet Wallet lets you do anything on their site, it takes you through a very clear description of what you can and can't do with Bitcoin, what the risks are, many of which we talked about in this interview. So thank you, Philip. We'll be right back after this short break with some more useful tips from the DIY Cyber Guy.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
Anchor ID is a new way to log into websites and mobile apps, all without a password. The key is your smartphone, literally. Your smartphone is the key that will replace the need for passwords to your online sites. Our next product will be available to Salesforce.com users soon. To sign up for the first year free, just go to anchorid.com/Salesforce. Visit anchorid.com/Salesforce and get your first year free.
Have you friended us on Facebook yet?
Why not?
Just go to facebook.com/Voice America or search for the keywords Voice America. Once you are part of our Facebook network, you'll receive daily messages about what's happening with our shows, this week's featured guests, and new happenings at the Voice America Talk Radio Network. And you can add your voice to the always active discussions on our timeline. Just go to facebook.com/Voice America or search for Voice America.
Listening to DIY Cyber Guy with David W. Schroefer. If you have a question for David, please send it to questions@DIYCyberGuy.com. That's questions@DIYCyberGuy.com. Now, back to the show.
And we're back with DIY Cyber Guy. We're interviewing Philip Andre. Philip, thanks for your segment on the joys of Bitcoin and blockchain. I want to move on to one of your tongue-in-cheek nicknames, the godfather of chip and pin. So for those of you out there who don't know, a chip and pin basically means the little chip that's being put on credit cards now. Rather, this is one of its meanings, the chip that's being put on credit cards now that require us to insert a chip or insert a credit card into your credit card machine at a store rather than swipe it. So, Philip, why can't I swipe my credit card anymore?
Well, I think we have to go back in history and understand what Visa, MasterCard, and at that point a company called Europay decided to do back in 1993 and 1994. At that point in history, there was a known problem that criminals, those same people who stick people up for their bitcoins, were able to replicate, to duplicate, to create a counterfeit copy of a payment card with a hologram and a magnetic stripe and the artwork of your financial institution. They were able to create perfect duplicates. So we needed to come up with a mechanism that would allow us to authenticate that your physical card was a genuine instrument, a genuine card issued to you by a financial institution. And at that point in time, there was a technology in the market which was called the integrated circuit card, or the smart card, and some people called it the chip card, that the French had been doing a lot of work to design and test, that had become industry ready. The proof of concept was done, the beta testing, the alpha testing, all of the work to prove that this technology was secure, that this technology would work at a global scale, had been done. So the next thing to do was to define the standards, the technology that would allow a point of sale device and a card to talk to each other, to communicate. And we decided that we were going to use cryptography, so the art of large number mathematics. We were going to use a chip, a computer that had memory and controls and power and all the other things that a computer needs to do. And we decided that we were going to figure out how to embed that into a plastic card. And we developed a standard. And in 2011, here in the United States, Visa decided that it was time to move to this global interoperable standard, to migrate from the use of a magnetic stripe as the means of offering to the merchant your card number, to a chip as the means of offering your card number to the merchant. And more importantly...
Okay, so the chip is what gives the card number, not the magnetic stripe, right? But so how are they different? How are they communicating? If it's the same, if my credit card number is my credit card number is my credit card number, then what's the difference between having this little chip communicated versus having a magnetic stripe communicated?
Well, I think we have to go back in history and understand what Visa, MasterCard, and at that point a company called Europay decided to do back in 1993 and 1994. At that point in history, there was a known problem that criminals, those same people who stick people up for their bitcoins, were able to replicate, to duplicate, to create a counterfeit copy of a payment card with a hologram, a magnetic stripe, and the artwork of your financial institution. They were able to create perfect duplicates. So we needed to come up with a mechanism that would allow us to authenticate that your physical card was a genuine instrument, a genuine card issued to you by a financial institution.
Okay.
And at that point in time, there was a technology in the market which was called the integrated circuit card, or the smart card, and some people called it the chip card, that the French had been doing a lot of work to design and test, that had become industry ready. The proof of concept was done, the beta testing, the alpha testing, all of the work to prove that this technology was secure, that this technology would work at a global scale, had been done. So the next thing to do was to define the standards, the technology that would allow a point of sale device and a card to talk to each other, to communicate. And we decided that we were going to use cryptography, so the art of large number mathematics. We were going to use a chip, a computer that had memory and controls and power and all the other things that a computer needs to do. And we decided that we were going to figure out how to embed that into a plastic card. And we developed a standard. And in 2011, here in the United States, Visa decided that it was time to move to this global interoperable standard, to migrate from the use of a magnetic stripe as the means of offering to the merchant your card number, to a chip as the means of offering your card number to the merchant. And more importantly...
So the secret, in the same way that we were just telling our listeners about the Bitcoin secret, which is something that you can and should write down on a piece of paper and put into a safe deposit box, in this case, you're saying the credit card is remembering that secret, or a continuously randomized version of that secret on that tiny little chip on the credit card. Is that about right?
That's the more importantly. If you think about your card, on your card today is a hologram. In the case of the Visa card, it looks like two globes. In the case of MasterCard, it looks like two globes. In the case of the Visa card, it looks like a dove. And that hologram, in theory, is supposed to be checked by the merchant to make sure that it's the right hologram. And 20 years ago, it was almost impossible to replicate a hologram. So it was an excellent means of authentication. But the criminal had figured out how. They knew how to replicate that hologram. They knew how to replicate all the other physical security features. Think about a dollar bill or a $20 bill. People are able to look at that bill and they're able to look at physical features and prove that it was a genuine $20 bill. Credit card, they were able to replicate it. They were able to duplicate it, and a clerk could not tell it was fake. So put the chip on it, a computer, use cryptography, very much like the cryptography we use in blockchain and Bitcoin, and use that cryptography just like the cryptography that we use to encipher communications so that people can't listen in. And if you all remember when Apple would not give the FBI the key to unlock the phone of a terrorist who had killed a lot of people out in California, we use that exact same technology, that exact same capability to allow the chip in the computer, in the card, to communicate with the terminal and deliver to the terminal and ultimately to your bank a cryptogram. And those parties in between could validate that only your card could use a secret to sign the transaction in such a way that the issuer knew that the card they mailed to you is the only card that could have signed that transaction.
So that's a fully functional computer that's sitting under that little silver plate. It's got processing capability. It can do command response. It's got memory. All of those elements sitting right there in that tiny little silver spot on each of our credit cards.
That's correct. Behind that plate, be it the palladium or the gold plate that's on your card, behind that plate is a chip. And we call that chip a secure element. And it is designed specifically to store the secret in such a way that nobody can read it. And when you think about Bitcoin, if we go back a second to our previous segment, you want your secret in one of those chips when it's actually executing a transaction. So somebody can't look inside your computer and find your secret. You want to store that secret in a secure element, something that's hardware that protects that secret when it's going to execute.
Now that's impressive.
Absolutely. I'll go one step farther. There is more computational power on your credit card than there was in the Apollo 13 the Apollo spacecrafts when we went to the moon.
Now, how much does that little chip cost? I mean, is it costing our banks, you know, $20 to give us all credit cards with these chips in them?
I have to be careful with pricing, but let's say that for a large financial institution here in the United States, they're probably paying 50 cents. For a smaller financial institution, as is always the case, volume dictates price. They may be paying as much as a dollar.
Wow. So it's not actually a lot of money, giving that it's more computational power than the Apollo spacecraft had back in the 60s when that was flying. Fascinating. So, Philip, where can people find out more about your work?
In terms of my work, my last name, andreae.com, is my website. And it is a website that's got a lot of material about a lot of what we're talking about. So EMV, which is the technology behind chip and pin, things about identity and security, and things about this whole new cyber world that we're moving into.
Wonderful. Well, Philip, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, David. And always a pleasure to talk about my favorite topic of chip and PIN and the being the godfather of what is now protecting our payment industry.
Well, you covered it well, and we've reinforced your nickname. So double win there. Just a reminder, if you have questions, just send them to questions@DIYCyberGuy. And hang tight. We'll be back with answers to your questions from listeners like you in our next segment. So stay tuned. Thanks very much for listening.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
Anchor ID is a new way to log into websites and mobile apps, all without a password. The key is your smartphone, literally. Your smartphone is the key that will replace the need for passwords to your online sites. Our next product will be available to Salesforce.com users soon. To sign up for the first year free, just go to anchorid.com/Salesforce. Visit anchorid.com/Salesforce and get your first year free.
Have you friended us on Facebook yet?
Why not?
Just go to facebook.com/Voice America or search for the keywords Voice America. Once you are part of our Facebook network, you'll receive daily messages about what's happening with our shows, this week's featured guests, and new happenings at the Voice America Talk Radio Network. And you can add your voice to the always active discussions on our timeline. Just go to facebook.com/Voice America or search for Voice America.
Listening to DIY Cyber Guy with David W. Schroefer. If you have a question for David, please send it to questions@DIYCyberGuy.com. That's questions@DIYCyberGuy.com. Now, back to the show.
And we're back with DIY Cyber Guy. So our next hack has to do with cars. So for most of us, this is a hair on fire one on a scale of 1 to 5, meaning we probably don't need to worry about it. But if you absolutely love your car and insurance isn't something that's going to replace it easily, and you happen to use a push button to start the car as opposed to a key in the ignition, then this is probably more like a 4 out of 5 for you, that you should really pay attention and do something to fix it. So what's the problem? Now, most new cars have a wireless key fob, FOB, which is basically a little device that allows you to start your car with just the push of a button as long as the key fob is nearby. It's very convenient, and all you need to do is keep the keys in your pocket when you start the ignition of your car. It's basically a little radio transmitter on your keychain. Now, the hack starts with somebody recording the radio signal that's being emitted from your key fob. Now, what that means is they need to stand within a few feet of you, and that's not as creepy as it sounds because it's about as close as somebody walking near you on a crowded sidewalk with the right piece of equipment in their pocket. So the attackers, and you need two attackers for this particular hack, they maneuver to both sides of your vehicle once they have recorded your key fob, and they use these tools to literally unlock the car and fool the car into thinking that the proper key is nearby. And then they do it again with the ignition to actually start the car. So without breaking into anything or smashing any windows or anything like that at all, no hot wiring here in the classic sense anyway, they have literally fooled the car into thinking your real key fob is nearby, and they turn it on. And if you want to see a really unsettling video of this actually happening, it was caught on somebody's security cam while the two hackers were stealing a Mercedes in the UK. You can go to the show notes. We've got a YouTube video, and you can see it all there. And we also have in the show notes the paper that was written by the people that discovered this vulnerability. So what do you do? This is actually one of two things you can do. One is obviously don't use your key fob, or at least don't take it into crowded places, which is probably not a viable option for some of us. And for the rest of you who want to really get around this vulnerability, you need a little purse. Now, I say that fully recognizing that there are those of you out there with a beautiful 68 Mustang that you have retrofit for your convenience, a push-button ignition somewhere, you know, hidden in the dash, and you probably want to pay particular attention because that car is not going to be easily replaced, I would imagine. So you put the keys in what's called a Faraday purse. It's not, they make them for men too. They can be a masculine thing, but it's basically a wire mesh on the inside of a bag. And if the keys are in that bag, the idea is no radio signal can penetrate it. Now, to my surprise, they actually sell Faraday cage purses. So if you go online and Google the words Faraday, F-A-R-A-D-Y, sorry, let me try that again, F-A-R-A-D-A-Y, cage purse, you will find lots of different options to simply drop your keys in whenever they're in your pocket, whenever you're out and about, anywhere but home. You just put them in the Faraday purse, and the hacker can't do that first part of the attack, which is to record the signal that's being emitted from your key fob. So not using it or using a Faraday key purse are probably the only two reasonable fixes for this particular hack. Okay, moving on. So comment about last week's broadcast, Meltdown Inspector. There are no actual attacks yet. That's very important to know. So although it's a vulnerability, the researchers found it in a lab. They have not seen anything, which, you know, what we're saying is in the wild of actual hackers attacking and stealing stuff off of real computers. So this is the first time that we found a vulnerability that's based on the way your central processor works, which is part of the issue here. So keeping your processor firmware up to date, and we can talk about that in a later episode, is really important. But keep running those updates. Keep looking for the updates. And if you want more information, we covered this in a lot more depth last week. So go back to the January 11th show, and we will give you lots more detail there. Of course, we have more links about this issue on our website at DIYCyberGuy.com. And that is all the time we have for this week's DIY Cyber Guy. Remember to send your questions to questions@DIYCyberGuy.com. And if you need more information, if you missed anything about any of the details or the steps, simply go to DIYCyberGuy.com and you'll see the show notes for today's show, January 18th. You can also buy my book, Digital Habits, on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. Just Google the words Digital Habits 5, the number 5. So again, that's Digital Habits, the number 5. Or go to, of course, DIYCyberGuy.com, and we've got a link right there if you wanted to buy my latest book, Digital Habits, or any of the other books that I've written. So thank you for listening, and don't let the web bugs bite.
Thank you for listening to DIY Cyber Guy. The information, opinions, and recommendations presented in this broadcast are for general information only, and we have not knowingly divulged any information that would conflict with any of our non-disclosure or confidentiality agreements. Please join your host, David W. Schroffer, next Thursday at 3 p.m. Pacific Time and 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Enjoy the Internet safely.